G'day everyone, thanks very much for joining me here. On this episode, Tom Lee Rutter is back for the second time to join me to talk about his new film, The Pocket Film of Superstitions, which he's just finished and he's now doing the festival circuit. Is that correct?
That is correct, James. Thanks for having me back, mate. Really appreciate you welcoming me back. I really enjoyed chatting to you last time when we were right in the middle of production of Pocket Film, actually.
Yeah, it feels like a long time ago now. So I'm going to be talking a bit about that. Well, I'm going to ask you questions about that, about how long it's taken and everything. But the last time I spoke to you, we ended up with you telling us a little bit about that film and what the intention was. And I think you had a kind of teaser trailer at that point. You must have shot a fair bit of it, but now it's complete and it's getting kind of rave reviews from what I've seen. I just have to say at the start, just so we get the interview off to a good friendly start, I'd say it's a pretty remarkable achievement for a film of this level, I think. It really is a terrific piece of work, and the love that's gone into it is so clear. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so special. So you just want to tell us a little bit about the film?
Thank you for that. Really appreciate it. The film is basically an almanac of various superstitions through the ages. I really want to take my cues from, Hexen, 1922, basically. I think I've made two films that really riff on Hexen now, and I don't think they'll be the last either. It was born out of the frustration of bringing actors back to do scene A, scene B, scene C. You know, that's a frustration of shooting narrative features when you've got no money and no schedule. So, you know, your actor will come back and his hair's longer or he's fluctuated in weight. So I really wanted to try and...
You're not thinking of anyone in particular with that one, are you, Tom? They're fluctuated in weight. Do you want to...
Well, funnily enough. But moving swiftly on... I found it was very liberating to make a film that was just fragmented in little vignettes, you know, and then to string that together with a narrator, which is what I did with Bella in the Witch Elm. And that worked out really well. And I knew that that sort of area of filmmaking, you're able to sort of mask loads of seams and even like, you know, loads of modernities of a set or of a place. You know, if you sectioned off this little bit here, that would look really photogenic, but this bit over here, not so much. So with a vignette, you know, you can really just mask all that sort of stuff. And then a narrator will tell the story. And then, you know, the people that you bring in to use, the actors, friends, whoever, they illustrate the piece without, you know, playing these sort of fleshed out characters, I guess. So I figured, how could I do that in feature length form? So on to the Pocket Film of Superstitions, which is the same sort of pool of sort of folkloric, folk horror, I guess, really. But I suppose, you know, to broaden it, I needed to bring in a different angle. I didn't really want to repeat myself. What I did with Bella was to tell a good story. So this time it was like, well, how about loads of little vignettes, throw in loads of Dadaist humour and quaintness, and just see how we go with it, really. It's a big experiment. It might not work, but we'll find out. And that took me 5 years. 5 whole years to get to the end. And here we are now, you know. So
for the 5 years, how much of that was... Well, the first question is, how much research did you do onto all these kind of superstitions? Was this planned out in advance, or was it information you'd already picked up or something that you had an interest in? How did you go about structuring this this script, which, you know, for the listener is really tiny little kind of weaves us through the history of superstitions, essentially? How did you go about stitching that together and getting a structure and getting the research? And
a lot of it was really suck it and see, because some sort of sequences became fully half formed in my head, you know. Like, for instance, the first sequence we shot was the Changeling sequence, which is a sequence a lot of people, you know, don't forget. it's a lot of people's favorite because it really does become quite creepy at that point. So we shot that in April 2018. So, you know, hot off the presses of getting Bella out there and doing the festivals with Bella, it was like, right, let's jump into the next one. and, you know, dive into the same sort of gene pool. So that was the first scene we shot, and that one was just like a need to film a scene depicting that. I wanted to depict a changeling. The idea of superstitions really was the, I suppose, again, it was born out of that frustration to work with actors. So initially I came up with a sort of 5 minute idea for a film that would just show hands, and it was all the different gestures and superstitious gestures that involved hands. And for some reason, it just grew to a sort of Ben-Hur cast out of that, really. In terms of a sort of approach, it was, you know, it was neither here nor there, really. I think at one point I decided, right, okay, so I need to think about a structure now. So what I did was I just listed a bunch of superstitions that I thought would make really good, you know, visual pieces, and then just work out how one would lead to the other. And sometimes I had no idea of how that would work, because in this list there was stuff that never really made it in front of the camera, for instance, and then there was other stuff that you know, I wanted to do, but either budget or time or just general just apathy towards the end. Maybe, I don't know. So I just kind of switched tact a few times. I think what happened was, halfway through filming, I realized, okay, I need to sort out the narration there. So I wrote the narration rather than just filming these scenes willy-nilly and then wondering where they were going to sit on the timeline. Because for a while, I'd have shot stuff shot in 2018. I had no clue where that was going to sit in the film, or even if it was going to make it into the film. It was just a case of, right, just do this bit, that bit, this bit, that bit. It was just such a patchwork sense of freedom about it that I didn't really care about that until later on, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I've got a question related to structure later. I'm just if you see me looking down, by the way, Scott, I've got my notes in front of me. I'm not losing interest.
Nodding off.
I'm not yet. Give me another 10 minutes, and
Yeah.
then. But I've got a question about structure I want to ask you in a bit. So, that's to do with anthologies and those kind of I would say not quite non, but or maybe non-narrative films as well. I guess we could call this a non-narrative film if we really
Yeah.
want to push that phrase. I'm not convinced on that. But so what was the production schedule then? So you started out in these kind of little bits, doing. You weren't too sure how they're going to fit together till halfway through when you got the voiceover, which really works well, I think. You know, ties it all together, stitches it together really nicely. When you're shooting it, did you put the effects in, or the rudimentary effects in then, or did you do it all after you'd completed the original rough cut of the film?
No, it was, I was editing as I went, really. So when we last spoke, you mentioned I put a teaser trailer, and then if you look at that now, it's all out of whack, really, in terms of you know, the, for instance, like, you know, the post-production wasn't complete on it, and it was in a different sort of aspect ratio as well, a lot of it. So it was very much me just finding the perfect balance, really, and learning new techniques as I went along. So a lot of the early cuts of some of the scenes looked pretty rough, to be honest. So obviously, as I kind of learned to work more with textures and stuff like that, that was partly the blessing of this film taking so long, really, because a lot of it ended up just being me sat in my office just tinkering away at the post-production, and some scenes completely just starting again, you know, and think of a new approach. And in some cases, some of the shoots, my camera work was pretty dreadful. So I was, you know, it's like, okay, I've set myself now a challenge. How do I overcome this? You know, and that was like, how do I get around this shot, which I hate, or how do I get around the lack of coverage in this bit here? Because of the sort of Dadaist mentality of the film, I was able to just cut away to anything I wanted to, given the right opportunity, you know. So it was just creating yourself that sort of that playground, really. In terms of shooting schedule, at the time I was working as a support worker, so monthly pay. So looking at my roads and thinking, right, okay, I can afford one decent scene a month, you know. And then you look at your road, put a date in, and then find all the resources of the location or whatever. So that budget would either go on the location, i.e. for the changeling, it went on the mixture of the location and the effects. In some instances, it went completely on the location, so everything else had to come for nothing. And in the case of working with name actors, it all went on them, and everything else had to come for nothing. So it was just working out where your budget went for each scene, really. And that's why it took so long, because I didn't have a big, you know, bunch of money to begin with.
one thing I really love about knowing you, speaking to other filmmakers who are on this scene, is how we can kind of like you can be inspired by other people who work in different ways, mostly to kind of keep the motivation up. How did you keep the motivation up for 5 years without losing heart, without tearing your hair out, and keep the not only the enthusiasm but the belief you're going to get this finished and it's going to be good?
So the enthusiasm never really waned, but the belief that it was going to get finished did. It became sort of, at one point I thought this is never going to get finished, and I can't actually picture a world where this is finished. Because, it was just a case of like, I can't, you're still looking at those little gaps on the timeline, and you know that you've really got to pick up all your energies now to just try and get that timeline, that bit in the timeline filled in. And to do that, you've really got to make some effort. And with a lot of this stuff, it was like having to, beg, borrow, and mostly beg to get locations that were unique. And sometimes that was either costly, or sometimes it took some convincing. And sometimes I just did not have the energy to do that. And you do really have to pick yourself up off the floor sometimes to really just get yourself back in the saddle and to get yourself over that line, So yeah, but this was the first film where, what I had in my head, or what an idea of how this film should look, it transpired in that way, because it's very much a post-production heavy film, which meant most of the joy and the magic was made in the editing room. So therefore, me on my own, that was my sort of, that was my idea of painting, really, is just, having that solitary sort of experience and really creating the scenes there, So whilst I weren't out filming a lot of the time, I was experimenting and learning animation, just this and that, the other. So on the positive side, that's what I was up to for a lot of it. But then on the negative side, it was just thinking, that it were never going to get finished.
Yeah, it's got a very painterly feel to this film. I don't think there's a single, I guess every bit of video you run through a computer these days is going to be treated in some way. But is there a single shot in the film that doesn't have some form of After Effects or some form of effect layer in it?
No, not really.
No.
I mean, I'm quite happy with making post-production heavy films, because I just like manipulating footage and taking things to the nth degree in post, because there's so many functions now. And considering I've used, say, Adobe for, well, since what, 2007 maybe, there's still half of it I don't know how to use, because there's so many functions to it, and I like to explore those,
But it's not, I don't want to give anybody who hasn't seen the film or seen the trailer an impression that this is haphazard or something you're just making up as you go along. It's quite clear that with your shot selection and where you've placed the camera, you had a real sense of what the effect might be. As you say, you've got the kind of masking around some of it, or you've got the sense you're going to be like superimposing images and compositing images. You've got that sense, I think, right from the start that that's going to be a factor in how you put this film together. So it must take a sort of real imagination to be able to look at the raw footage, as you say, even if you don't like the camera work and you don't like this or that, you don't like the location, to still have the faith that no, I'm going to turn this into looking exactly as I want to. You must have a real good vision there, Tom.
Oh, absolutely. Well, a lot of it was designed really just to manipulate. Like, for instance, the changeling scene, like I said, that was the first scene, full scene we shot. But then the edit, the shot that takes us from the fairies to the changeling, it's a hand reaching into the lens, and then it reaches outward into the next scene with the bubbles from the last scene following that. But that was one of the last things I shot, because I knew how to link that scene, but I just, for a start, needed to get a baby, and and then a crib, and I always knew that shot was designed to do that, basically. Whereas like Steam with the Stone Circles, there's a scene where there's a whole coven of people stood around the stones, but there was only three of us there, so it was a case of sitting the camera still and blocking off the shot into four sections so you can multiply the people. Again, it's just knowing what to do on the editing room whilst you're filming something. So you're filming something and you think, well, I'm going to do that to this and do that to that. The idea is to do this to that. And you know, like when the archaeologist, the anthropologist, sorry, are looking for the fairies, and then they find the fairies. I stuck a big cardboard sheet of blue in the bush, so obviously you got size head here, and then a sheet of blue card there, which I was going to key in the fairies afterwards. So yeah, you always must have the mechanics of how that shot's going to be pulled off in your head or on the timeline before you go and shoot it. And then you got all the pieces. You can go and lock yourself away for a week or so, just enjoying yourself, you know.
I'm way too primitive for that. I panic. I look at the footage and I can't imagine it looking good ever until I've like and
I get that too.
Well, you've got a really good sense, I think, of much more of that than me. For me, I need to see it in camera. It's almost as if I don't believe my own vision half the time. I think that's the that's the problem. But
But we
what
all have that
I don't
struggle,
know.
which is probably why I overcompensate in the post-production room.
Well, that's just the plan of what how yours is how yours comes together. Let's talk before I ask the next question. Let's talk about the locations because I mean you're here, there, and everywhere, right? I mean mostly around the Midlands, but even further than that.
Oh yeah.
So tell us about some of the places you went to film and whether the research you did to plan some of this out.
Well, it's part of it is like a map of indie, really. Like whoever's in the indie scene, sort of thing, we'll get them involved. For instance, like the opening scene was shot down in Portsmouth with the Trash Arts crew, so they facilitated that shoot. So we went and found a location in Portsmouth somewhere which they knew of. And then others were like locations that I grew up around, you know, like for instance, the haunted house sequence was a Victorian manor house, fully furnished in a park near where I grew up. And you know, I'd go and visit that place as a kid, and then I'd have dreams about it because I'd imagine myself trapped in there, or you know, I'd hear all about the ghosts that you know wandered around the corridors. So I always wanted to film there. That was a definite, and because it was a local council, we were able to negotiate, you know, a donation to just be let loose in there for the day. Whereas, you know, there are other desirable locations which are National Trust and the like. And you've got less chance of, you know, getting your foot in the door with those unless you've got some serious money. Others, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Others, it was a case of just basically looking for, you know, Victorian places that were within reach because a lot of it is Victoriana. I mean, the stuff there is. We had a lucky find with the changeling sequence. That was a medieval merchant's house, but that was in a museum in Bromsgrove called Avoncroft, where they uproot loads of old buildings and situate them all in this, you know, same space really. So you've got like a 1950s house, you've got this medieval merchant's house, you've got this old toll house, you've got this old corrugated church, these random buildings all thrown together. But they were good because they let us pay the entrance fee and then just crack on really. Whereas others were a little bit more sort of expensive, but it was just basically just seeing what was out there that wasn't sort of National Trust, I guess, really.
I'm glad you mentioned Avoncroft Museum because I saw that on the list of the year-end credits, and I went on a school trip to Avoncroft Museum when I was about 13. So,
Really?
yeah,
Yeah.
although I couldn't remember and I always wanted to go back, and I couldn't, re and I was watching it, and I thought, I wonder if he's gone to Avoncroft Museum for it. I thought maybe Black Country Museum, maybe that's a bit they'd ask a bit too much to go in there. But I thought maybe he's gone to the Avoncroft. That's possible. But so I was glad I
Yeah,
saw it coming on the
you got
end
Black Country
trip.
Museum, you got Iron Bridge, you got, le but again, a lot of those are legit sort of budget. I mean, Black Country Museum, not that I can condone it, but you know, it's a good place to go guerrilla, I guess, really, because it's such an open space that you could probably get away with a handheld camera and someone dressed up and then just get the shots you need, especially with the sort of films I make, because if they're sort of vignette based, you only need to get the money shots really, and then location sound and all that, just throw that out the window, you know, and just get what you need and get out. But
Yeah,
yeah, Avoncroft were brilliant.
I definitely thought that about. I mean, those open spaces, great. I mean, you walk around Black Country Museum or the Avoncroft, and you do think. I mean, you want to be let loose in there. It was a bit like it's like a gift. So it is really good. I'm sure you felt really good going into somewhere like Avoncroft,
Oh wow, yeah, you just
and you really exploit it, Tom, as well. You really in the film really exploits the sense of location, which is
We were
true.
lucky with the Avoncroft because there was these ceiling spotlights, so everything looked really well lit. And then, I can sort of take credit for that. But in fact, it was just we were locked out at the time. But yeah, like you said, it's amazing when you're kind of handed a period setting or a period because that's production value, And for a film that doesn't really have much production budget, you want to get as much of that on screen as possible, really, And then it does look like there's a bit more effort being thrown into it because, I've made all those sort of indie films when you're kind of honing your skills and just get learning your way around the camera where, you ask your mate if you can film around their house and then you got like a your mate's houses or your own house and all that. But then there comes a point when you're like you want to take yourself out of those familiar sort of handy surroundings and push it a little bit further and see what you can get for next to nothing. And that's what we did with this,
Final question about the locations. You've got a really striking final shot in this film. I won't tell people what it is, but it's a terrific final shot that the end credits run over. Where was that?
That's Clee Hill. So literally just up the road from where I am here in Kidderminster, really. So the Clee Hills are absolutely gorgeous. You've got loads of old mine shafts up there and whatnot. So it's like some sort of alien landscape, And we caught it on a day where there was a lot of drizzle, which was brilliant because added to that haze, really. I've shot a music video there before for an artist called Rhea, and again, I had her wandering around the landscape and whatnot and put some filters on the, in front of the lens. When I say filters, I mean sweet wrappers. And then, create this sort of weird alien landscape with what we had around us. So I always figured I wanted to go back there. And the idea is, at the end, is that we are still wandering into the unknown. I love that idea of, there are no answers. We are wandering into the unknown. And that's, I guess, what this guy does at the end. So I needed this sort of this location that best illustrated that. I think at first it was trying to catch the roads in Clear because the roads when you get the mist and the fog, the road is literally a road to nowhere, and I just figured that was too hard to time a time when we'd have the fog and the mist and the actors' availability. So we just thought, well, let's just go up the top of Clear Hills and see what we can get,
You mentioned about the drizzle and the haze and the fog. You got the drizzle on that final shot, and I think it gives it a texture. I think it's what we're talking about. And there's a great texture throughout the film. In fact, you could argue, or I would argue, the film is about visually, it's about textures, right? It's about you've got like layered images, composited images. You've got even within every shot, you've got multiple different textures on display. You've not only got the kind of skin of the actors, you've got the different clothes that they're wearing. Some kind of they're wearing different kind of costumes. You've got the different textures of people's hair, of the wallpaper, which kind of, like you say, was kind of Victorian, kind of these Victorian places. The brickwork. I mean, and also, I don't know whether I'm taking this too far, but there's just the texture in terms of some of the vignettes are about things emerging out of cracks, right? You've got this crack in the pavement at one point, that things that are coming out where texture is really important. And I just think that's one of the strengths of the film. The visuals really match the themes, I think.
Thank
Really,
you.
really
Yeah, I
matches it.
mean, I really went to town on some of those scenes. Like for instance, there's been screenings that we've had where people have said certain sequences have maybe gone on a little too long, but I love that because I love the overindulgence of the fairy sequence because the fairy sequence, as you say, is all about. So the How would you sort of create the texture of a fairy sort of environment, a magical sort of fabric? And it was just layer upon layer of these psychedelic sort of kaleidoscopes and then shimmery things. And, I'll just get lost in all that. So if I can sort of manage to make a feature film that is mostly just texture and weird stuff, but still come through at the end, not alienating your audience, then that's the kind of film I want to make, really,
Yeah, well, it is the kind of film you've made. So tell me, this is a question I was going to ask. It's maybe a difficult question. I'm trying to find it actually where I've written it down. Okay, here we go. There's this thing, isn't there? There's a problem, I think, not just at this level that we're working at, with anthology films, in that they never really get great reviews. And I think the reason for that is is because they're constantly reaching a peak, dropping back to the start, reaching a peak, dropping back to the start. So even in a movie, right, you're 20 minutes from the end, right? And the climax is building up. In an anthology film, it just drops back to zero again in terms of the pace. So I just wondered how, and it doesn't necessarily have to relate to this film because it's not really fair to call it an anthology in the normal way we would describe this as a film. But how did you get a sense of building to a climax with this movie? Was that anything that went through your head? I've got a kind of sense from watching the film how I think it might do. But I just wondered whether you had any thoughts around the structure across 90 minutes.
It was it's an experiment I'm really proud of, to be honest with you, because the idea was, and you're right that it's not an anthology in the broadest sense, because I didn't actually see it as, I saw it more as, well, an almanac really. So an almanac is a book where, again, a book like so this one, by the way, this was an influence, dipping into. So some entries are a lot more fleshed out than others, which is the case with some of the entries in the film. But I liked it in a sort of stream of consciousness approach where, we're led from one to the other. There's bits where that could have been elaborated on, but oh no, it's too late now. We go moving ahead. You're walking through some sort of exhibit, which, there's so much to take in. So a stream of consciousness was the idea, really. The prime sort of idea was that, you go from one to the other, and then something random, and then something back again. So that was the idea. But then it was a case of, right, how can we sustain that for 90 minutes without, I don't know, boring people, I guess, or losing them, or I don't know, because, it's very hard for films to abandon the traditional narrative structure and still not lose the audience. So it was a case of, right, I'm essentially making experimental films, but I don't want to alienate an audience. I want to still feel a warm connection with the audience. So that was always a prime operative. In terms of reaching the peaks and the troughs, it's a case of, right, knowing when a scene has to breathe and things have to go a little quieter, because, for instance, my composer Kragos, he's a sort of kitchen sink kind of guy, really. He loves filling things with little sounds and little bits and this and that and the other. And I'm very much the same visually, but then there are moments where you're right, okay, this needs to breathe a little bit now, or people need to get their breath back. So it's a case of, you need to know when, okay, this scene's a little more humorous, this one's a bit more serious, this one's mournful, this one's a bit scary. Right, we need to go funny again. But before we go funny again, let's bring it down so it's a bit quiet, slow it down a bit. And then when we bring it back up again, we can go a bit more full pelt. So it's a case of, right, just taking into account those tempos, really, and knowing that at certain periods in the film, say the middle, for me, the middle's like the fairies and stuff, people are really treated, then people who have persevered are treated and rewarded for that. And then the latter act, you've got your Caroline Monroe witchcraft sequence, which is for me the eye of the storm. That's the sort of as big as it gets. And then after that, it's sort of just coming out of its trip then, and then finding a way to tie up somehow. So so yeah, it was taking all those into account and just knowing and hoping that we'd put them in the right places and, struck all the right chords, really.
That's exactly what I was thinking, actually, is what I was going to say. I think you reach a kind of the more they feel like more significant pieces, where it seems to settle down around the idea of the fairies into, I believe it, did you say the fairies, it's into the changeling sequence
Yeah,
or
that's
near.
right. And that's the midway point, really. I think when we vignette out of the haunted house sequence, we are at the midway point. And I feel like that first half is sort of people either get with that or they don't, or they're intrigued. And if they're intrigued, then I feel it gets better, as the sort of middle kicks in.
Yeah, I think that changing sequence, I think, changes the tone a little bit, because I think it's the most serious part in the film. And I think part of it is to do the it's all of a sudden it's far less whimsical than some of the rest of the film, obviously intentionally. And the performances by the actors are all of a sudden very serious. I mean, the just playing the mother and the guy playing the father. You know, take it as serious that as they can, right? I
I
mean,
love it.
there's a real power to that bit where she's kind of howling and upset, you know,
I
with.
originally wanted to go for like a Jan Zwankmajer sort of stop motion sort of, otherness about it, but it was just time. And Rachel made us a great puppet where we could just feed the twigs, through its mouth or out of its mouth and then just reverse the shot sort of thing. But the idea was to do a couple more, sequences that were that sort of serious, but they just didn't quite pan out to be as serious, I guess. So that was probably the most dramatic bit, like you pointed out earlier.
Yeah, and it's followed. I think that's followed by the coven sequence with Caroline Monroe, or it's near enough around there. And as you say, you think that's the best bit, but it's a more significant sequence, and it really seems to settle into a mood. And the tone of those three sequences, the fairies, the changing, and with the witch sequence, feels more, more serious. More, it's got it's more, it's got for me anyway. It's got substance to that. Rather than those little tiny, more comic ones,
Yeah.
situate the rest
I
of it.
mean, I never wanted to mock the the source materials or the I just wanted to there's never really any mocking in the film. It's more so just the irreverence and the Dadaist sort of humor, but it's also then kind of rude not to sort of really delve into those mood pieces and the atmospheric parts and really go to town on those. I mean, again, you'll notice the witchcraft bit and the fairy bit. Two sequences where people have said they maybe go on a little bit, but I just love that. I want to drag that out as much as I can because it's all about living in that sort of mood and that atmosphere rather than waiting for the narrative or the film to push along. It's taking a little break to just sort of soak it up,
Yeah, I mean, I've got my thoughts on that when people say that a film or a sequence goes on too long. I mean, it goes on as long as the fucking filmmaker wants it to go on, isn't it? Right.
Yeah, I mean, I do like to take on board feedback, and if I do watch a film again and think, yeah, you know what, that bit is, I will cut it down. But for this one, it's like, nope, this is exactly as long as it needs to be. This is how it's staying. And you know what? I think there's a sense of restlessness sometimes when people watch films with an audience if they're kind of waiting to get to the bar or go to the loo or something, You've really got to find yourself whisked away, haven't you? And some screenings have done exactly that, whereas others I find maybe they'd soak it up more if they watched it at home. I don't know. I don't know.
You mentioned that not all of it made it into the film. What was the material you left out? Was this material that was unshot, or shot and you didn't edit it, or and why was it left out?
So I think one of them was going to be about a plague doctor and a plague spirit. Jungfrau or something. It was a German sort of name for a spirit that came in with the plague and would take away people who were dying of the plague sort of thing. Again, that was born because I'd seen the upstairs of the medieval merchant house in the changeling sequence, so I wrote that sequence around that. But then I found it was, I don't know, too similar to ghosts, I guess, really. So it was like, well, you could use that one or you could do the traditional haunted house piece. And with the traditional haunted house piece, I'd sort of add my, dream location, and I wanted to condense the woman in black in like, 3 minutes. So we went with that instead. So that was out the window. I started buying like, some props like the plague mask, plague doctor mask, and some bits and bobs, but it didn't really go any further than that, really. And plus, the staff had sort of had a switch around at Avoncroft, so. After that day of filming, it was nigh impossible to get an answer out of them to go back. So I just sort of nipped that in the bud, really. I mean, I really wanted to film several other pieces there because it would have been so handy. But when just like that person who made it all kind of possible was sort of out of the equation, I just figured it probably wasn't going to be that easy again to get back in. So I stopped pursuing it. There was another one about the Eye of Hamza, with the sort of Hamza hands that you could get in Morocco. That was tied in with the old evil eye thing because the hand of Hamza with the Eye of Hamza. That was I shot a couple of shots of the wife in Morocco, got her wearing some like Habib's, and that. I cut that out, so I didn't really find a place for that because there were some really nice shots of the Valley of the Casbahs that we visited. So I just figured, well, I'm losing some really nice travel log shots, but it could do without it. So I didn't really want to get too questionable. There was also a really fleshed out scene involving amulets and talismans around some slaves getting their sort of revenge on the slave master, but that was too murky in terms of, my portrayal of said sort of history, dodgy history, and I suppose trivializing their sort of beliefs in that sort of weird Dadaist mix. So I decided against that. That was really early sort of sequence that soon went. That would have been another sort of serious one, but I don't know. I was a bit worried about how I was going to handle that one, so that went out the window as well. I don't think there was anything else that was too substantial, really. I think there was just bits and bobs that I just thought, well, get rid of that, get rid of that. That can function without that. That can function with that. That sort of thing,
My next question is about it. Maybe it's a two-in-one question, and I just don't know whether I suppose there's a kind of British no-budget, micro-budget horror scene that's either developed or developing. You've mentioned Trash Arts down in Portsmouth, and you've got Michael Fausti in the film as well, I think. So Andrew Elias, who made Tales from the Great War, you've got other filmmakers who are involved in this. I noticed well on the end credits that I think I've got a thank you right at the very end as well.
Everyone gets a
I
shout
don't know what I did to, what have I done to, I don't know what I did to deserve that, but thank you very much anyway.
out. You were kind enough to have me on your podcast before, where I rattled on about the film, in a time when I thought I was still surprised that anyone wants to hear about it, to be honest. So yeah, that would have been your dues for that, But yeah, so you got Michael Faust in there, and the end scene, in particular. With the shrink, everyone in that sequence is a filmmaker. You got Andrew coming up the stairs. You got John R. Walker, who's the guy who has his brain taken out of his head. He made A Ouija Geist and a film called Amityville Playhouse. So he made a couple of spooky feature films. And then Pablo Raybould was the psychiatrist. You can see him in a lot of stuff. He crops up in a lot of stuff as an actor, but he's also a director. He directed a film called The Snarling and a follow-up film to The Snarling called The Last Twitch. He's just co-directed a film about an injured darts player, I do believe, called The Broken Arrow. That's just had a premiere in at the Southend Film Festival, actually. But yeah, there's loads of filmmakers popping up. Because again, it's one of those situations, isn't it? We help each other out. So if you do this bit for me, I will do this bit for you. We're just all happy to help see our vision sort of reach the finish line, essentially. And as Andrew pointed out, that we have this shorthand where, you could waste a lot of the day trying to convince people who aren't filmmakers to do things, or you just got this underhand. You have this speak where people understand each we understand each other, what needs to be done, and you will fulfill all these different roles, wear all these different hats, as long as you get through the day in one piece, so that's why there's so many filmmakers in the film as well, because it
Yeah.
is a patchwork of it is a real scrapbook of people I've met and like collaborating with, and it's the sort of film that it is. With it being an almanac, it's enabled me to create all these different little bits and bobs with different people and create memories of each one of them, So
So what has the feedback been like so far when at the screenings, and how have you felt that those have gone? Have you been doing any, I don't know if you've done any Q&As at any of these festivals so far?
it's generally been brilliant, really. What I've really liked is that it's tempted some people into watching it who wouldn't probably usually watch it, and they've enjoyed it. Some screenings have gone unanimously great. Others, you feel that sense of, oh, it could go either way, because I welcome negative reviews as well as positive, because we need to restore a balance there, and you don't want to kind of find yourself down a path where you start believing your own hype, because it's fatal, really. You got to make sure you screen your films outside of a comfort zone where, you're less welcomed with open arms, and people want to see the film for what it is rather than for knowing you and people on the screen. So, but generally, it's been great. We had a great Q&A session down in at the Romford Horror Film Festival, where Pauline Pert, Caroline Munro, and the narrator, The Shend, got to join us and be a part of that, and watched it with a packed crowd. We were so chuffed because there were some heavy hitting films on that weekend, and there were some heavy hitting special guests there that weekend. But to see a packed out auditorium to watch the film was just amazing. And again, that was one of those screenings where it was totally less biased. You could go either way. You don't know what the room's thinking, because some bits that you've found people laughing at in other screenings, they haven't laughed at here, but then you've generally had a real positive reaction afterwards. But that was a great Q&A, and it was sort of a dream come true to get, those people up as part of the Q&A with me, and it premiered down in Great Yarmouth, at my friend Celine's event, 50 Years of Classic British Horror, where it was sort of sandwiched in between the screenings of like Theatre of Blood and The Wicker Man. And obviously for those screenings, you had Madeline Smith there and Britt Eklund. So you can imagine a lot of people weren't there to see my film. But then people were there to see my film as well, which was really heartwarming. But you can imagine how, I think, bless Celine, I don't think she realised the film was that long for a start. I think it was squeezing in another feature film to, add to the stress of maybe her, bringing the day together, and obviously added to the pressure of me knowing that some people were there just to meet their idols and watch their favourite films on the big screen, and then you got, little old us in the middle sort of thing. So that was a fun kind of run of the gauntlet sort of thing,
But it went down okay. You felt that the response was
Yeah,
positive.
it was great. Absolutely. I can't be happy with all the screenings it's had. It's screened in front of so many great people, like-minded individuals. It screened at the Festival of Fantastic Films in Manchester, where Darryl Buxton interviewed us, and there's some great people in the crowd there watching. People that you wouldn't imagine. It was like, wow, you saw the film. They're like, yeah, it was really good. It's going to the Butt Film Festival in the Netherlands in at the end of August, and they want us there, so I'll be going over to that. That's the B Movie Underground Trash Film Festival in Breda in the Netherlands. That's been going for like what? That's in ni its 19th edition. So they've invited us to go screen there, so I'll be going along to that. And yeah, it's playing Greg Lamberson's festival, the Amazing Fantasy Fest in Buffalo, New York, in September, which I most likely sadly won't be going to. But it's just great that, I mean, I've had like, short term sort of, runs with Bella and stuff like that, where I'm really, really grateful for the festivals that I've taken on. But Bog of Film, it's sort of played more now than I ever imagined, because it is, when you compare it to a lot of films made now, even on a low budget spectrum, it is a very lo-fi film, which I'm totally cool with. But there's films now made with such better gear that it does stand out when you look at some of the other stuff that's out on the circuit. So I'm chuffed that it gets to sort of have its moment with those sort of films,
So, with Bella, your last film, I think you self-distributed that. You published the Blu-ray or the DVD, and you sold that. What's your plans for distribution for Pocket Film of Superstition?
Well, so I don't know if you know, but I work for a label called Treasured Films. We release cult films on boutique sort of Blu-ray. We might be going down that route with it. I mean, either way, I'm going to be, making sure the film has a Blu-ray release that, is something that people would want to collect or own, So, but yeah, watch this space on that front. Don't want to give too much away yet, just in case it doesn't happen, sort of thing. But there will be a physical media release of it for certain, because, with a film that unique, you want to sort of make the package kind of correlate towards that as well, and have something going on with that as well, maybe, just to make it so people people would want to own it, I guess, you know.
While you're here, do you want to tell us a little bit about Treasured Films and what you've released so far and how that came about?
Yeah, sure. So it was actually through Bellew and the Witch Elm. Graham, who runs Treasured Films, sort of watched Bellew and couldn't believe that I was local to him because he's in Dudley, you know. And I couldn't believe he was running an online emporium called Film Treasures from the Black Country. So I went to see his lockup, and you know, he had all the amazing boutique labels on the shelves, and you know, before long, he sort of offered me a job, and in that told me that he had bought the rights to some films to release, and so before long, I'm sort of editing a couple of video essays for him, and now we're sort of, you know, in the thick of releasing a run of films, really. So we've already had three released, with two more up for pre-order now. We're announcing a sixth title tomorrow. And they have films like, you know, Antonio Margheriti's The Last Hunter, that was the first release. Jeff Lieberman's Satan's Little Helper, that was the second release, which is where I started coming into the fray. So I started editing some of the video essays for that release. And then Mausoleum has been our third release, which has been brilliant. Really loved working on that one. We did a good release for that. And Dawn of the Mummy is up for pre-order now. That's done very well because Dawn of the Mummy has had a checkered past in terms of a quality, you know, release. So we're chuffed to be able to put out a release with a version of the film that's as good as it can get, since the negatives, you know, AWOL. And the other title is a sort of post-Scream meta slasher called You Might Be the Killer with Alison Hannigan. So again, we're sort of aiming that at a different sort of areas of the horror cult market. See how it does, you know. It hasn't done as well as Dawn of the Mummy, but I think that's for obvious reasons, really, you know. So yeah, and we've got one coming tomorrow. So by the time this has gone out, it would have already been unleashed. So it's The Island, Peter Benchley's with Michael Caine. So we're putting that out as well. And then on the horizon, we've got a couple, we've got three more to get out. And then we're looking beyond that, basically. So that's where Pocket Film might come into play. So we'll see. But I just love the fact that it's in the Black Country. You know, we bonded on both being yam yams, essentially. And, you know, our offices are in the town where, you know, my nans are. So I grew up in those neck of the woods, and I just find it amazing now that we're doing this sort of thing in this neck of the woods. I mean, where Graham grew up, he had Duran Video, you know, in Dudley. So we're sort of following in those footsteps, I guess, really.
And with Dawn of the Mummy, I think you had Amanda Reyes contributed an essay for the release. Am I right there?
That's correct. Yeah, she's contributed a release on models in movies, you know, like photo models and stuff like that. So she's delivered a really good, cool piece there. We've got a real eclectic bunch on that one. You know, Kim Newman, Barry Forshaw, Stephen Frohwer. Stephen Frohwer is always delivers the goods, you know, Daryl Buxton. So yeah, good cast of characters, really.
Excellent. So my last question, or my last but one question really, is back to the filmmaking rather than the distribution. Is what's the hardest part for you?
I guess the hardest part really is having the confidence to put a project forward for people to get involved with, and having the confidence of them being interested, actually genuinely interested, not just trying to keep you happy. You know, it's finding that team of people who are just as into the idea of making this film as you are, and overcoming those, you know, imposter syndrome things, really, which I guess we all have. So yeah, I think it's just, I feel like I've built up some confidence with Pocket Film, knowing that Pocket Film is still that sort of partway through the journey kind of film, where I'm still aiming for something that I haven't quite reached yet. Hope I never reach it, because that's what keeps us making the films, right? So I feel like Pocket Film is that stepping stone film. The next film is pretty much where it's going, but where that film leads to, who knows? But I know where I'm going next. I just hope that I don't derail it, really, you know. So yeah, it's just having the I suppose the hardest part is getting to that point of mounting a project and knowing that everyone in part involved with that project wants to make that film as much as you do, you know.
And that leads neatly to the final question. Definitely the final question is what is next?
Well, again, that's something that I like to usually say because, you know, it can jinx a project. I've done it before in the past. And when you've got like millions of potential projects in your head, it could easily kind of switch gears and go to one of those other ones. But for now, it's a project about undines, so water elementals. So we're going in with that sort of, again, the folkloric vibes, the fairy tale vibes, the sort of hazy black and white vibes, but we're mixing it in this time with more human drama, so the characters are more fleshed out. The characters will be narrating, not a narrator with marionettes. They are going to be fleshed out characters. It's about undines who sort of find their love and gain mortality to walk the earthbound realm rather than, you know, the ocean life, and they find that it's not what it's cracked up to be with the general anxieties and mundanities of, you know, of human life. But they're drawn together by each having, you know, the set of three undines, and we go from each of their sort of experiences, and they're sort of tied together with each having recurring dreams of houses, because, you know, houses do represent sort of fractured mental states, or, you know, they can represent stability or instability, you know, that they can represent several different things. So they each have recurring dreams of houses. So there's your sort of dream logic, surreal stuff going on as well. How that's all going to come together, I don't know, but we're heading somewhere with it, you know. We're bringing other writers on board. I don't want to name them yet because I want to start getting some pen to paper first, and then we'll start to sort of roll out as the progress sort of starts to mount up, I guess, really. Don't want to jinx it, basically.
That's totally understandable. Listen, Tom, once again, thanks very much for coming on. And when that film's done, hopefully we'll have another chat again. Well, hopefully we'll get to meet up at some point before that.
Yeah, that'd be good.
But thanks very much for coming on. I think the
It was a
film.
pleasure as always, James. Thank you, mate.
No worries at all. And my final word on it, as I said, I think it's a remarkable achievement. I think even at this level, even if people didn't like the film, which I'm sure there'll be only be a handful of those in the world who didn't like it,
You'd be surprised.
but even they would have to say, for the level it's worked out, the level of imagination, I think it really stands on its own. So well done.
Thank you. Really appreciate that, mate. Thank you.